Book of Genesis, please, in chapter 12. Genesis in chapter number 12. I trust that it will be concise and short, and we'll leave time for another speaker before the break. Genesis chapter 12 and verse number 4. So Abram departed as the Lord had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. Verse 6, Abraham passed through the land unto the place of Shechem, unto the plain of Moreh. And the Canaanite was then in the land, and the Lord appeared unto Abram and said, Unto thy seed will I give this land. And there he builded an altar unto the Lord who appeared unto him. And he removed from thence unto a mountain on the east of Bethel, and he pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west and Hai on the east. And there he builded an altar unto the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. And Abraham journeyed still going toward the south. Chapter 13 and verse number 18. Then Abram removed his tent and came and dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron, and built there an altar unto the Lord. Chapter number 22. Verse 1, it came to pass after these things that God did test Abram and said unto him, Abraham. And he said, Behold, here I am. He said, Take now thy son, thine only Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of. And Abraham rose up early in the morning, and saddled his ass, and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and clave the wood for the burnt offering, and rose up and went unto the place that God told him. And on the third day Abraham lifted up his eyes, and saw the place afar off. Verse 14, And Abraham called the name of that place Jehovah Jireh, as it is said to this day, In the mount of the Lord it shall be seen, or the place where Jehovah will provide. I want to follow quite simply, from what we have listened to already, what I had been meditating on in relation to what we'll discuss in the afternoon that has been mentioned quite a few times already with the help of God and our brethren in Hebrews chapter 11. My mind went back to the four generations of the family of the patriarchs that conclude for us the second half of this tremendous book of Genesis. It is an amazing thing that the first 11 chapters of Genesis cover almost 2,000 years of early earth history. God is not so much concerned with the individual walk of one man. Really, what God is painting for us against the background of a divine creation is the rebellion of humanity. And then when we come to Hebrews chapter number 11 and 12, the Spirit of God, as it were, changes the pace and the scope and the scale. And God spends the rest of the book from chapter 12 to chapter 50 talking not about the great disasters and the problems and the rebellions. He speaks about the progress of faith in just one family across four generations. If I said to you this afternoon that Abraham's generation, the first generation, is the generation marked by conviction, I think we would all agree. If I said the second generation, the Isaac generation, is marked by consolidation, I think we might be comfortable. I could have said convenience. The third generation, the Jacob generation, oftentimes marked by compromise. And the fourth generation, the Joseph generation, marked by incredible crisis. I stand here in front of you this morning, a stranger to some. Third generation in the assembly. My grandfather has been in glory for 35 years. He paid a price. For coming out of the denominations, he didn't do it just all in one go. He did it gradually as he discovered aspects of truth, so he followed it. Until God led him into fellowship in the assembly, and he stayed there happily the rest of his days. So my father and my aunt, two of them, second generation, grew up and remained in. My father's now an old man and not long left in this world. Second generation in the assembly. Third generation, already difficulty and trouble, depart, you're coming into that generation of the family. And then I stand here today, and I could tell you about our family. My wife is here. We love them dearly in the Lord. We trust they'll all be with us in glory for all eternity. They all made a profession of faith, though some are not living it out. Not one of them gathered to the name of the Lord Jesus Christ in assembly fellowship. But what I want to speak about for a few minutes, very simply, and maybe follow in different aspects and into the sessions that we'll continue in, those of us that remain next week, I want to look at the spiritual progress of the patriarchs. I want to see that God has given us waypoints. I'm a great believer in the old garment system. I haven't got converted over to Google Maps. There's deficiencies and problems. I'm an old-fashioned man. I love in a garment that I can put in my waypoints. Somebody asked me that just the other night. We struggled, some of us, to find a house, and we got the house. And then when we got the house, the person in the car said to me, "Now, will it be easy to get here the next time?" I said, "Oh, it's so easy. I just touch the screen." And I put in a little waypoint, and I give it a name by which I will remember. And as long as that old machine works, be it in Africa or Europe or North America or Canada or wherever, now I can put the waypoint in, and it will remind me that I was there before, how I got there, and actually where I went after I left. When we come to the story of the four generations of the patriarchs, God has given us in a tremendously wonderful spiritual manner. For God is up there, eternally existent, unchanging, millions of miles beyond the satellites, and yet his eye is on every single activity of our journey. God has given us the waypoints of Abraham, and the waypoints of Isaac, and the waypoints of Jacob, and the waypoints of Joseph. We have read in the story of Abraham this morning that Abraham raised on four different occasions, four new altars. He worshipped more than four times. Some of those altars he used more than once. Some of them he returned to and came back again, and he had to take stock of where he'd gone and what he'd done before he came back to the same altar a second time. But the Spirit of God records for us that Abraham raised up, left his waypoints on his spiritual journey. The generation after, and the generation after that, because when we compare the genealogies, Abraham overlived Jacob by at least 15 years. I wonder, we're not told, but I wonder how much information Jacob got from Abraham. And the Spirit of God has marked down for us 3,000, 4,000 years afterwards that we can go back into the divine record of the Word of God and mark the spiritual progress of Abraham by his waypoints. Abraham, he raised up four altars. We'll touch on them just for a few minutes. Jacob, when we come to his story, he raised up four pillars. A different symbol, a different object, a different marker post, a different waypoint, and yet the pillars of Jacob in his journey. I love the story of Jacob. The pillars of Jacob and his journey are very easily seen because Jacob was a man who travelled far and vast distances and back again. When you come to the story of Joseph, when you say we all know the story of Joseph, what did he do? What did he raise up? Where did he go? Did he build altars? Four times the Spirit of God records that he changed his garments. And even then, that seemingly simple act and the difference in the garment from what he changed it to and what he changed into marks for us spiritual progress in the pathway of Joseph. You say, brother, you left out Isaac, the second generation. Well, I left him to the last. Strange, isn't it, that when we come to the story of the patriarchs, there seems to be the least said about Isaac. These are the generations of, and then Isaac seems to get less, the second generation man. Now, I called him at the start the generation of consolidation. It is true. And yet there is a sense in which the second generation is the generation of convenience. He didn't move very far. He didn't travel very much. And the sad thing about the story of Isaac is this, because not only is there spiritual waypoints, but I've often considered when I come to the story of the patriarchs that really their spiritual life can be graphed out, just like yours and mine. A little tiny kind of spiritual ECG. God's cardiograph of your spiritual temperature and mine that really only he himself can accurately measure. Abraham was a man who started well. By the grace of God and the influence of the flesh, we've heard of that this morning, things went quite up and down. And yet by the grace of God, he finished well. Jacob, I'm moving to third generation again. I'll tell you this, dear child of God, Jacob started bad. The beginning of his graph was somewhere down there at the very bottom of the axis. And yet I want to tell you this, of the four, he probably finished at the highest. One of my favorite chapters in the whole of the Old Testament is Genesis chapter 49. The high point of the conclusion of the spiritual experience of a man like Jacob, that neither his fathers nor many that came after him rose to a prophetic height that Jacob rose to in Genesis 49. That's encouraging, isn't it? That a man can start so low and by the grace of God can end so high, and he was third generation. And you say, what about Joseph? You know, Joseph's beautiful. He seems to exist on a spiritual plateau. Mind you, there's not many of us have done that, and probably none of us ever will. He begins in his story right at the start. There seems to be blessing and beauty and shepherd care and spiritual character. It's envisaged in the very life of a young teenager to the point where he's hated by his brothers. Why? Because of the deficiencies in his personality. No, we'll maybe come to that next week. Just because of the godly consistency and character and affinity with the Father that the rest of them had a hatred for, a man. And he just continues on that level, a shepherd. Oh, the scope and the scale gets bigger and bigger and bigger and grander. He cares for the Father. He cares for the family. He cares for the flock. He cares for the nation. He finishes up caring for two nations. For he fathers the whole of the nation of Egypt, and inside that he fathers the whole of the nation of Israel. What a man. Dear child of God, we come back to poor Isaac. I've left him again last in the four because, you know, Isaac started well. And sadly, poor old Isaac, in his spiritual experience, he didn't finish as well as he started. A man who was marked out by a loss of spiritual sensitivity at the end of his days. His touch failed him. His taste failed him. His smell failed him. His sight failed him. And the only sense that was left hearing, and he couldn't depend on it. And the spiritual graph of Isaac, I'll tell you this, it starts here and it doesn't go in the right direction towards the end. Come back to Abraham and his altars just for a few minutes. I'm calling the first one the altar of confirmation. He came to the place called Moreh. It means the place of the teacher. His second altar, I'm calling it the altar of communion. Bethel. House of God, what a lovely place that appears again and again in the journey and the waypoints of the patriarchs. Mamre, a place of strength. I'm calling that the altar of his confidence. And then Moriah. We read that at the last in Genesis 22. A place that was marked out and chosen by Jehovah. And I'm calling that the altar of his choice. Abraham at 75 years old, he comes into the land. We know the background, even the young people, they know the backstory of Abraham. God had called him. It's significant that Genesis chapter 12 begins with spiritual retrospection. It's not the call of Abraham in 12 and 1, it's the fact that God had called Abraham prior to where the Spirit of God records it in 12 and 1. And in that tremendous grace of the Spirit of God, he doesn't actually tell us when he called Abraham first. We just know that God had. Back there in Ur of the Chaldees, we know what God told him. We know how God challenged him. We know where God called him from. And he didn't know, but only God knew where he'd called him to. Get out of your country. Get out of your kindred. Leave behind your father's house. Fulfill the conditions that I have spiritually set before you. Pay the price of separation. Make the choice and take the step, and I will bring you to blessings that you have neither seen nor imagined. And the dear patriarch and saint of God, I'm calling him the man of conviction of the first generation, and yet right at the start he compromised. For he took with him the generation before his father. And he took with him the generation after. He had no son at that point in time, and so he took his nephew. And Abraham said, I'm going to step out in faith with God. I'm going to leave this and I'm going to that, but I'm going to compromise, because in my compromise and convenience, at least I'll take two other generations with me. That's really where Steve left us, isn't it? It's why I really felt I should come in here. Because we see that until God moved in grace, and he buried his father, and only then did he cross over and begin the true journey of walking by faith. And yet, when he was not able, because God removed him and taken that generation with him, he still brought with him, New Testament terminology, a saved man. Of that I have no doubt. A believer in his soul and in his heart in the same principles and worship as Abraham did, but a man that never marked it out in his life. If there is a waypoint, if there is a waypoint in the spiritual journey of Lot, it's the pillar of salt that marked the grave of his wife. A terrible thing. The rest was burning and ruin and destruction. You say, what stands beside Abraham's altars, beside Isaac's wells, beside Jacob's pillar, beside Joseph's garment? We have the warning of the story of Lot. His end is so grievous we would hardly touch it in a public place. And the only marker post and the only waypoint and the only thing we might discern physically left as a marker post is the pillar of salt of his unbelieving wife. And Abraham brought him with him. And Abraham took him down into Egypt, a place that neither of them never really needed to go. And when they went to Egypt, they got only outside the place of blessing. They saw and learned and heard and brought and took things with them on the journey that were a spiritual hindrance as they move forward. Abraham came into the land. The interesting thing, it says, the Canaanite was then. That carries a lot of resonance in 2018, doesn't it? The Canaanite was there in the land. The Lord appeared to him, and he built an altar unto the Lord. The interesting thing is this, and some of you folk will likely not have noticed it, that we're not told about what Abraham put on his altar until we get to chapter 2, and the first thing he put on his altar was his son. That's amazing, isn't it? I have no doubt there was a sacrifice on the altar, but in chapter 12, the sacrifice is not described, be it lamb or goat or heifer. And in chapter 13, the altar at the beginning and the end, again, is not described. And not until we come to chapter 22 do we discern by the inspiration of the Spirit of God, looking back almost 4,000 years of spiritual history, what was it? And was it 12 stones or not? Maybe the 12 came afterwards. But there was a little tiny cairn, a little tiny upstanding, a little place where the man gathered together on purpose out of the ground and put together in a place and put the wood on top and selected a sacrifice and burned it there, and the smoke ascended. And Jehovah was pleased with his worship. I'll tell you this, dear child of God, what I see in the early experiences of Abraham is this: God was pleased with his testimony. And that's what the Spirit of God was telling us. The focus is not on exactly what the man put on the altar. The focus is on where he built the altar, and what he did at the altar, and his association with the altar, and the people who were round about watching him when he did it. He built an altar unto the Lord in the place of Moreh, the place of the teacher who was doing the teaching. It was Abraham. And he's telling the pagan Canaanites who were there in the land, for the Spirit of God mentions in the very same sentence, it wasn't an empty land. Mind you, God had put a curse on the Canaanites, but that was not something that God used Abram to work out. And all these enemies, and all these pagans, and all these possessors, and all these heathens, they're round about in the land, and here's a newcomer, a stranger, an incomer, an alien. And they're saying, what's he going to do, and how's he going to mark himself out, and what's his first behavior in this new place? He built an altar. And he called on the name of the Lord. Steve talked about carrying the Bible around. Mind you, that's good advice. There's some young people in the audience here today and lately, you know, moving away from home and getting out of the Father's house and stepping out on the first stages of the journey of Abram and going to college and being away from home for the very first time. I'll tell you this, that marks a mighty challenge in the life of a young believer. And it's not that every single one's waiting and yearning and wanting to go away. We had a boy like that in our home. He couldn't wait until the influence of missionary home and missionary family and all those other things. And when he left, I remember the day I took him to the airport, I weighed his bag, it weighed 9.5 kilograms. I said, son, he said, that's all I need. And he went as far away physically on this earth as you could get, the way down to the South Island of New Zealand, and he's still there today. You know, dear child of God, dear grandparent, dear parent, dear mother, dear father, dear young person, dear aunt or uncle, dear shepherd amongst us, it is not easy when young people step out. And it's not that they all want to be rebels, and it's not that they all want to go away, but some of them face difficulties and problems and decisions, aye, and questions and conversations that they've never met at home. And I'll tell you this, the first time is actually the easiest time. Not the hardest. You see, we think the first time we bring out the Bible, the first time we bow our head in McDonald's or in Starbucks, I better be careful, or in Tim Hortons, and give thanks for your breakfast. Oh, you say, somebody will see me, somebody will mark you out. I tell you this, the first time is not the hardest, the first time is the easiest. Because then you've taken the stand, and the second time it's not nearly so difficult. And from that comes the question, and comes that from the understanding in the hearts of others. Something here is different. And we have met some in our travels in other lands, even in Africa. And sometimes the simplicity of a bowed head, and the lips moving, and you can see they're not conversing with the person across the table. There's a little pause, there's a little hiatus, and sometimes by the grace of God, because of God-fearingness in Africa, you'll even get a waitress or a waiter standing back. And they don't want to bring the next thing to the table because here are two people with bowed head. And they're making their very table in the coffee shop a kind of a representation of the mercy seat that God has blessed and God is blessing. If I'm only giving thanks for a coffee and a donut, I tell you this, I'm setting a testimony and a marker and a standard. I wouldn't take time this morning to tell you of some of the conversations I've had in coffee shops in Canada. Just because a man sat down beside me, a total complete stranger I've never seen before or since, and they felt willing to start a conversation about scriptural or spiritual things because a strange guy that he didn't know from Ireland took off his baseball cap and gave thanks for his coffee just by himself. Abraham built his first altar in the place that the Spirit of God has called the place of Moreh, the place of the teacher. I've called it the altar of confirmation because it was where he came into the land first, a stranger from home in a strange land. He said, I'm going to continue in the way that God intends. I'll build an altar. I'll give thanks. And they'll worship. His second altar is placed at Bethel. We have it a little bit further down the chapter. Listen to the spiritual progression in the story. He built his altar, did you notice, having Bethel on the west and Hai on the east. If you ask some of my older brethren, they could expound that whole story for you. Because moving east and west, that geographical direction, west to east and east to west in these early chapters of the Word of God are amazingly spiritually significant. And here's a man he has on the east. It's not the place that he left, but it's the direction that he came from. There is a place called Hai. What's it mean? It means heap of ruins. And there is on the other side, the west side, and that sets because when you've 2 points, and you've 2 waymarkers, then you can determine direction. The man has left the place called the heap of ruins. And he's moving in a very specific direction, and he's going towards a place called Bethel, house of God. And halfway between the heap of ruins and the house of God, he builds a second altar and he worships God. I'll tell you this, dear child of God, every one of us that's saved in the room today, we should be. And I trust that we understand that we are, no matter what age or generation we belong in, we're partway on the journey from the heap of ruins to the house of God. And the older we get and the further we travel and the more we leave behind and the more we set down and the more we realize it was useless baggage, the more we understand we're only trying to get away from a place that is a heap of ruins. And would that our altar way marked every single piece of the journey upwards for each one of us should reach. It's not about a big house. On the upper slopes of the nicest valley and the biggest possible fifth-wheel RV in the yard and a boat for the summertime and a ski-doo for the wintertime and all the other things that are materially possible. Dear child of God, when he takes us away, we're leaving nothing, taking nothing with us and leaving it all behind. And I trust that as young believers in the Lord Jesus Christ, you really can get a grasp of this. I'm not criticizing. That we're leaving behind because God has asked us to, a place that's just a heap of ruins. And we're stepping forward and we're moving out and we're going home to a place that's called Bethel, house of God. It's no accident that when we come into the New Testament, God takes that very same lovely title, divinely so. It's not that I see the assembly in Genesis 28, no. That's maybe over-spiritualizing what's there. But God takes that lovely title, house of God, and he brings it forward into the New Testament, post-Pentecost, church truth, and he says where we are and where we belong. You see, we don't have to wait until we get to the house of God in heaven. That's what we heard at the beginning. Because by the grace of God, he has provided for us house of God down here. Oh, it's not the house of God, for that is heavenly. But it's house of God, and it's here for us. And we have learned in our journey, when we travel, no matter how far it is, and no matter how much baggage we have to leave behind, and you come to a place where you've never been before, and you just find that true fellowship, house of God. There's nothing like it down here on earth until we're all home in heaven. His first altar, the altar of confirmation. His second altar, the altar of communion. Mind you, he came back to that altar a second time. I want to leave it and come to a quick conclusion, for I do want to leave time for someone else. Mind you, that second altar he visited twice in very quick succession. And the sad part of the story is, in spite of all that I just have said, from heap of ruins to house of God, he left that second altar with all it geographically and symbolically represented, not east to west on his journey, but north to south, down to Egypt, into the world, looking for help and sustenance in the middle of a difficulty and taking everybody else with him and doing harmonious testimony in that land that his nation never fully has recovered from. And where did he come back to? Chapter 13 and verse number 2, the place where his altar had been at the first. Not the first altar, but the place where his altar had been at the first before he began the journey down. The journey away and the journey south, and you say, how far did he go until he learned that God could not bless him unless he came back? And where did he come back to? Exactly the same place as he had departed from. You speak to some of the older saints at lunchtime and you'll learn this, that when there is departure and failure and a little tiny bit of rebellion and moving down a cul-de-sac that wasn't the purpose of God, you know where we have to come back to? Exactly the place where we left. And there are so many out there today, and you know, if they were honest, when we talk to them privately, they'll tell you this, we left the place where we should have stayed. And we haven't come back because of pride in the flesh, but you know what, we're not happy in the place where we went. And if we could swallow our pride, we'd come back again, for we know there would be true happiness in the place that we left and went away from. His third altar, the altar of confidence, the altar of Mamre, after. This is nice, isn't it? After Lot had made the decision, mind you, humanly speaking and fleshly speaking, Lot seemed to make the right decision, didn't he? He went where the grass was greenest. He went where the valley was widest. He went where the river was annual and flowed all the time. He left the place where there was not enough room for the pasture and cattle, went down to the place where there was plenty room. And we touched last night on the old man watching the declining lack of progress, degeneration of Lot until the tent disappeared forever. And it seemed to be, humanly speaking, that Lot had gobbled up all the green grass in the land. And yet God appeared to Abraham and said, it's yours. Follow me and walk in faith and walk in confidence with your God. He hasn't made the wise choice.
for he hasn't made the spiritual choice, and Abraham is confirmed. And his confidence is strengthened again in his God, and in those circumstances, for it was grievous and it hurt. And he's alone with his God, and he builds the altar. And he takes a place of confidence before his God. We come to the last one. I don't need to spend a lot of time on it, do I? It's an interesting thing that whenever Ishmael, we'll not talk about Ishmael, it was the flesh, fleshly activity and fleshly work, thinking he was doing the purposes of God and working it out in the flesh. And the conflict arose in the family, as we would have expected the conflict to arise, for the spirit and the flesh can never be joined together except in conflict. And Sarah says, cast out the bondwoman and her son. And in chapter number 21 it says, Abraham took bread and water. And he rose up very early in the morning, and the thing was grievous to Abraham. In chapter number 22, it says he took the wood and the fire and the knife and his son. And he rose up very early in the morning. And it does not say that the thing was grievous unto Abraham. That's amazing, isn't it? The bottle and the water, earthly provision, for the son begotten in the flesh, he was not of promise, and it was grievous to the heart of Abraham. And God tests, and God speaks, and God said, there's one altar more, and to gain that you must climb, for this will be a high point. And this will be a way point that will stand not only for Abraham's journey, but for eternity. For he's going to mark out the very place of Moriah, where there will be the sacrifice that God was going to delight in. And Abraham took the wood, and Abraham took the fire, and Abraham took the knife, and Abraham took the son at that point in time as an unknowing victim. And yet it does not say the thing was grievous to the heart of Abraham. Why? Because he's walking in faith with his God. He's walking in fellowship with his God. And we learn this afternoon when we come into Hebrews chapter 11, I trust we get there, that the Spirit of God shines light on it and explains to us with illumination from the New Testament, looking back in the Old, how it was that he was able to do it, trusting God, and faith in his God, and believing that if God has asked him to do that which seems to be impossible, God can further work and do again that which is impossible. That if Abraham has to sacrifice his son, God can bring him again from the dead. The whole typology and spiritual picture of it, we do not find hard to understand, but it points forward to Christ. But what I want to emphasize as I sit down this morning is this, the spiritual waypoint of this old man. How easy it is to criticize the partial obedience and call and the baggage he brought that he shouldn't have taken. The altar of testimony, the departure to Egypt, having to go back again to the place where his altar had been before. And yet look at the finish and the conclusion that the Spirit of God gives to us. How could he do it? I can't explain it, and we can't fully understand it. A man who had learned to trust his God. And a man who was willing to understand the sacrifice. If I am going to walk on the highlands of fellowship with my God for the rest of my days, it demands that every single thing that I hold dear is put on the altar of sacrifice for Christ. It would be a wonderful conference if one younger person of a second or third or fourth generation this weekend would realize that truth. To attain a high point for God and have waypoints in my journey that can be acclaimed and appreciated at the judgment seat of Christ. It's necessary to get to that place. Romans 12, 1 and 2. And put every single thing that the flesh holds dear on the altar for God, that I might walk without baggage in fellowship with him according to his call. May the Lord bless us all.